Israel has sent troops and tanks into Gaza. They started this last Wednesday after Palestinian fighters seized Corporal Gilad Shalit in a cross-border raid last Saturday. Those holding the corporal have demanded that Israel release hundreds of jailed Palestinian prisoners before they will free the soldier. Israel has refused and has launched airstrikes against the main Gaza power plant and road bridges. Israeli fighter jets have been bombing in Gaza and the West Bank, and the Israeli army has been shelling Gaza. Much of Gaza, including two main hospitals, is without power and water, and 1.4 million residents of Gaza are days away from a humanitarian crisis, according to the UN aid chief. Israeli forces have arrested up to 32 Palestinian MPs, elected officials in the West Bank, and are holding them in jail. On Friday night, they threatened to kill Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh if Palestinian militants do not release a captured soldier unharmed. This threat was delivered in a letter to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israel, as Israel debated a deal offered by Hamas to free the corporal. On Saturday, Israel's Air Force attacked the office of the Palestinian Prime Minister. He was not in his office at the time of the helicopter strike. That's some of the situation happening in Gaza. And I'm going to be speaking in just a second with Mark Galasko, senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch, about the current situation in Gaza, but also about the shelling deaths that occurred on a beach there June 9th. So right now I'm joined on the phone by Mark Galasko. He is a senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch and has recently returned from Gaza, where he investigated the June 9th shelling deaths of a Palestinian family on a beach there. Hello, Mark.
Hey, it's amazing how quickly we go from crisis to a really hot one, isn't it?
Seems a bit nonstop, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, the things were getting very tense when I was there, but it never ceases to amaze me how just quickly things can almost go to a shooting war almost at a moment's notice.
So I want to talk about the current situation and Human Rights Watch, the position of Human Rights Watch on what's happening now, some of what I was just talking about. But first I want to go back to the shelling that occurred on June 9th. You went there representing or working with Human Rights Watch to investigate this situation. What did you find?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Originally my team didn't go there to look at this particular incident. We had already had a mission planned for some time to go into the area and look at the Qassam rocket attacks that are fired from Gaza into Israel, and then the Israeli response using artillery fire. And so it was just serendipitous that we happened to be there when the attack happened. And we went to the scene as quickly as we could. We got there 24 hours after it actually happened. And to be honest with you, I didn't think it was an issue. The Israelis very quickly apologized, and from what I saw at the beach, it was fairly clear to me that it was an artillery strike that killed the family. And so I didn't really think much of it, and my team moved on, and we were looking at the different areas throughout Gaza that are hit daily from artillery. You know, there are 7,700 rounds of artillery have struck northern Gaza from the time of the pullout up until the time of the beach incident. And so we were just really looking at many other things when all of a sudden Israel changed what they were saying, and immediately we were thrust kind of into the limelight of basically putting forward this competing hypothesis for what happened at the beach. And so, you know, I've got to say that, you know, we were there right place at the right time, but it's one of those things where you just happen to be there when something big goes on.
What did happen at the beach?
Well, you know, I think there's no question that there are 8 civilians that are killed. There's no question that Israel was shelling the beach at the time. I think what the real question is about is, were the people killed by an Israeli shell that was fired at that moment, or was it an Israeli shell that had been fired earlier, or perhaps something else? I mean, from the evidence that we found there, collecting both shrapnel, looking at the collecting both shrapnel and paper evidence from hospitals, looking at the size of the crater, looking at the wounds that people had received, speaking to doctors who are very experienced on a daily basis pulling shrapnel out of patients, looking at all the different evidence in a very holistic manner, basically we came to the conclusion that these people were killed by a 155-millimeter artillery shell, which is the same type of shell that falls on Gaza every single day, and just really tried to determine then how did that shell get there. Now, Israel admits to firing 6 artillery shells from their land-based artillery and 2 from their sea-based artillery at that time. However, they have accounted for 5 of the land-based artillery shells and for 2 of the sea-based, but they can't account for 1 of the land-based. They've lost it. Their radar didn't pick it up. And so they say, you know, according to their mathematical permutations, there's a 1 in a billion chance it was that one that killed the people. So he said, well, you know, it could have been that 1 in a billion chance, but let's give them that. What else could it have been? Well, from 3 a.m. to 11 a.m., Israel was pounding the beach with artillery. And, you know, when artillery strikes sand, you have a very high chance, or certainly a higher than normal chance, of a fuse malfunction. So it's certainly possible that one of those earlier shells buried itself in the beach and then was exploded later on when it was upset during the actual artillery strike. And then thirdly, and I think an extraordinarily remote possibility, but one that we have to put out there, is that some Palestinian militant group set up an artillery shell as an improvised explosive device, a la Iraq. I think that's very remote, however, because while we see some minor leg injuries to the survivors and to those dead, no one lost a leg. And if you're going to have a subterranean explosion for a weapon that's laying horizontal in the ground, or a landmine, as the Israelis also claimed, you're going to see loss of limb, loss of legs, or loss of a foot. And that's absolutely not what we saw. And so we presented that to the Israelis, offered them all of our information, and they roundly refused it.
I want to, before I get into how why they refused this or what the ramifications of that are, another reason that I've heard stated that this is a remote possibility that it would have been some kind of underground device, mine, I suppose, put there by a Palestinian militant group, is that this was a beach that was frequented by Palestinian families from Gaza, and it doesn't make any sense that, you know, a Palestinian militant group would lay a mine there to deter some kind of what Israeli government claims were, was that this might have been laid there to deter some kind of beach assault from the Israeli military. Well, it's just a lot of folks have made the statement that this would be very unrealistic that a Palestinian militant group would put a mine there. And not only that, why one solitary mine on this whole beach where Palestinian families go all the time? It just doesn't make any sense. What do you think of that argument?
Well, even before you bring logic into the whole thing, you know, I think you have to look at the evidence on the ground, and the size of the crater is not consistent with a landmine. The wounds to the people there are not consistent with a landmine. The history of the conflict, the Palestinians do not have access to traditional landmines. And if they rigged something up, sure, that's possible, but then everything else works against that. And so I don't think it was a landmine. Now, if you look at it logically speaking, this is a beach, as you said. And let's be honest here. The only nice thing in Gaza is the beach. That's all these people have to do. And they're not doing it right now just because of the utter fear for what happened there. And so to think that you're going to mine a very populated beach, I think, you know, it begs the question, really, of why someone would do that. But really what we need to do is just go to the lowest common denominator. If you're shelling a beach and sunbathers die in an explosion, they've probably died from a shell.
And what I've read is that the wounds were not consistent, that they were consistent with an above-ground explosion and not one of a below-ground explosion.
Yeah, you know, you're seeing primarily torso and head injuries, you know, very minor leg injuries, you know, pieces of shrapnel here or there, but nothing major. You're seeing people who are eviscerated, arms lost, hands lost, people whose, you know, one little girl, top of her head taken off. So you're seeing just massive trauma to the torso and head, and very minor, if any, injuries to the lower body. And so I think that just really speaks to an above-ground explosion.
One of the things that the Israeli military claimed in their investigation of it was that the shrapnel wasn't consistent with an Israeli shell.
Yeah, you know, I really don't have any problem with that. And I would expect that you're going to find a lot of stuff in people when you remove whatever debris is in their body. I mean, when a bomb goes off, it's an awful lot of stuff flying through the air very rapidly. Car keys, your cell phone, your Frisbee, whatever else there is, rocks, pieces of metal that are laying around, piece of your car that might have, been taken out. And so to think that there's going to be some debris from somewhere else, I have no problem with it. It's quite telling that the Israelis have not stated what that metal is that they pulled out of the people. You know, if they're able to determine it's not 155-millimeter artillery shell, well, by all means, please tell us what it is. There's a lot of stuff flying around. Now, I'm quite upset by the fact that they've said, well, you know, it's kind of ridiculous that the Palestinian doctors removed all the shrapnel from these people because that shows that they were trying to hide evidence. And my response is, look, if my little girl has shrapnel in her body, that doctor just better damn right take as much out as he possibly can before he gets it on to the next level of care. And so I think it's really upsetting. Yes, there is that level of mistrust between the two societies, but please, we're talking about kids here. Let's get beyond that.
I'm speaking with Mark Galasko. He is a senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch and has recently returned from Gaza, where he participated in an investigation of the June 9th shelling death of a Palestinian family on a beach there. Israel has denied responsibility for this, the deaths of the Palestinian family, and has, I believe their official position is that it was an underground mine placed there by Palestinian militants. Is that so, Mark?
Well, actually, the last that I spoke with them, they still say that their investigation is not completed. I, of course, immediately replied, well, how can you have any conclusions if your investigation is still ongoing? I think once they felt they were able to absolve themselves, they were ready to move on.
So basically, they've absolved themselves through the media, but they haven't actually concluded the investigation officially.
That's correct.
Because the media picked up this whole thing and just pumped it out, you know, in the U.S. and Israel and around the world, that they were stating they were not responsible.
Well, I have to say, you know, there have been quite a few, though, that have been carrying the torch for us. The British media in particular has been very good. You see the publications such as The Independent and The Times of London, the BBC as well. They're really doing fabulous work on continuing to keep this out there. But, you know, it's one of these things that's OBE, overcome by events. And so while it's tragic and horrific, we have to also understand that there is a current crisis going on there, and people are more focused on that. And I can certainly understand that, to be honest with you, because we're dealing with a crisis that's going against a large living population right now.
Yes, but that current crisis is a direct result of things such as the shelling of the Palestinian family on the beach, the killing of civilians. I think probably directly leads into things like the taking of the Israeli soldier. And it's hard to say where it all, you know, go, but you can go back and you can say, oh, no, they started, whatever. But it is relevant, I think, to the current situation.
Oh, no doubt. And in fact, this beach killing was probably one of the main trigger events for what happened. I mean, you have just very quickly, if you look at the timeline, Israel pulls out, they begin daily shelling in Gaza, the Qassam rocket attacks pick up, then Hamas says they're not going to fire any Qassams, and there is in fact this ceasefire that they hold on to. But one of the problems is they don't stop some of the other militant groups, and so the Israelis continue daily strikes. You have this killing of the family. The Israelis cease fire with the artillery. Hamas picks up their rocket attacks to the point of upwards of two dozen a day. There's a huge outcry in the Israeli public for a response. The Israelis then do an airstrike against two members of Islamic Jihad 2 days after the strike against the family. This nets another 11 civilians, many of them ambulance drivers and EMS workers who are, you know, gathering up the injured. This further ignites anger and then leads to the attack against Shalit and the other IDF members at that outpost.
Now, before I really want to get into the investigation that Israel did and what you think of their investigation. But I want to go back just briefly to the June 9th shelling on the beach. Where were the family members standing, or where were they when they were killed? Were they standing by taxis? My understanding from what I've read is that a lot of people were fleeing the beach because the shelling had been going on, and they were trying to get taxis away from the beach to get away from this. Was that where they were when they were hit?
Yeah, halfway between the water and the road, there's kind of this flat, hard, compacted sand area where you can drive a car down to, and this is where people, it's kind of like the loading and unloading zone for this beach, very regularly used. And many of the families fled at the first shell, but some of the people were congregating around the area waiting for their cars to come down, and while they were waiting, that's when the shell came and hit. The Israelis state that their target was actually 300 meters away, and so, you know, they felt that 300 meters is far enough that you're not going to harm civilians. I think we would hold that 300 meters is certainly questionable at best when shrapnel is flying 500 meters.
Now, some of these taxi cabs, were they hit, damaged? Because I'm curious if some of the shrapnel in the bodies could have been flying from the cars.
Well, not only that, but some of the cars were impacted, multiple shrapnel entry areas. And I actually went into one of the cars and cut into the seat cushions for one of them to dig around for shrapnel, and I pulled out a piece of a 155-millimeter artillery shell, offered it to the IDF, along with the other information that we recovered. They responded, you know, this is not firsthand, this is secondhand. I said, no, this is something that I collected that was cut out of the vehicle. It needs to be tested because I think this is a fairly good chain of custody that it can be attributed to this strike. And their response was, well, you know, the Palestinians could have planted it, at which I kind of threw my arms up, and you wonder at what level do you believe the conspiracy is, where then every hospital record has to be falsified, just the amount of shrapnel that has to be laid in a very fast order, and really when it comes down to it, you still have 8 dead civilians, and it's just kind of saddening that they immediately punt to the idea that, well, it's all a conspiracy theory.
You cut into the seat to get the shrapnel out?
Yeah, that's right.
And there was a lot of witnesses too to this incident, so I mean, I guess they'd all have to be making their stories up.
Well, you know, that's what I was told, and I took an awful lot of witness testimony, and on the large issues there is complete and total agreement. Now, on some of the minor points, you're going to have some crosstalk because, you know, people are traumatized, and I think it's ridiculous to think that folks should all be standing there with their watches and telling you precisely when artillery shell 1, 2, and 3 hit. And so on some of those minor points, we may not have agreement, but certainly largely the testimony matches up very well.
Tell me what the significant parts of that were, of that
testimony. The significant parts of the testimony are that people are at the beach enjoying themselves, and then quite suddenly there is an explosion which immediately precipitates an exodus from the beach. And within short order, another 2 shells land, at which time people who are congregating together waiting for automobiles are then killed. Ambulances are called, arrive at the scene, remove some of the folks. And as the ambulances are there, there are strikes. There are further artillery strikes. And what's interesting is if you go back and check the 911 call records, they all match up. The ambulance records all match up. And so, you know, originally the Israelis made a very big deal about their timeline, saying, well, it must have happened after 5:15. There's no way that, our strike was what caused it because it was between 4:30 and 4:50, and they ceased fire at 4:50. And we were able to show by cross-matching the blood records, which are computerized data, and the cell phone records of the 911 calls that absolutely the incident occurred during the Israeli artillery strike.
Can you talk about the Israeli investigation into the shelling deaths?
Yeah, well, you know, the Israelis did a really very good job when it comes to analyzing their own information. They took out the actual M109 howitzer, which was the one that fired all six rounds. They tested it. They did computer models using the radar tracks for all of the shots that they made, cross-matched it with overhead imagery, photographs from the ground. And so they did a really solid job when it comes to analyzing their own information. The problem is there's an awful lot of evidence out there that they have refused to even consider. And how one can have a comprehensive investigation when you only look at one piece of the evidence is just beyond me.
What were they refusing to look at?
Well, they refused to look at anything of Palestinian origin, whether it was shrapnel or witness testimony or hospital records, anything. Even if it was really solid stuff computerized, it was questioned to the point that it was immaterial to them.
Did they see the bodies?
Oh, only the people that are actually in Israel being treated. And so, you know, my point to them was, look, I was there. You know, you weren't. And we all realize why you weren't there, but why don't you take some information from the people who were there? And their response was always, well, you know, you're tainted by this Palestinian perspective.
So they're not just disregarding information or witness testimony or hospital records or evidence from the Palestinians, but also from Human Rights Watch, from you.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, I would certainly consider us independent. Sadly, they don't.
So what do you think that says of their investigation?
Well, I think it shows that the investigation is shoddy, particularly when I met with Major General Khalifi, who heads the investigation, and he stated that the Palestinians are a lying people. And if you have your chief investigator who is prejudiced against the other side, I don't know how you can have an effective investigation. In the United States, if there was some kind of an incident with, let's say, the U.S. military in California, and someone was killed, and somebody said, well, you know, they're Hispanics or blacks or women or whatever minority you want to pick on, how can you trust them? I think immediately that chief investigator would be removed from his position, and somebody else would do the job, and there would be an investigation of the investigator. But that's not the case here.
So is there a specific conclusion of Human Rights Watch of your investigation that is available?
Yeah, you know, our conclusion is that they don't have all the information. We don't have all the information. Certainly everything we've seen points to an Israeli artillery strike. And so since no one's got the full picture, there has to be an independent investigation. The Palestinian government has sent us a letter stating that they will allow an independent investigation. To date, the Israelis are not interested in one.
Do you think this is just all going to be forgotten then, and people who will defend anything that the Israeli military does will just say it's either all a lie?
Well, I think there is an element of a population out there that will defend, you know, Israel or even the Palestinians to no end, regardless of what any evidence shows. But I think what's critical to remember is, you know, we at Human Rights Watch will be coming out with an extensive and exhaustive report on this incident as well as the overall picture. And hopefully that will, you know, when that report comes out, re-energize things.
Did you meet with the girl who lost most of her family there?
I did, yes. I met with her. I met with her brother and a number of the other survivors. It was quite awful, really massive, massive mental trauma. These people are not getting the mental help that they need, and it's very, very sad, but there's just no capacity, really.
What would you say to someone who, and I've heard this argument, as you say you have as well, that basically the Palestinians are all liars, they're just making all of this up. If somebody said that to you about the young girl, the one who pictures went out around the world of her grieving there on the beach right after her family was killed, if they were to say to you, she was just acting, she just made this all up, just a big lie.
Well, I think I would just try to be as dispassionate as possible, as difficult as it would be, and just say, look, you know, if you all of a sudden saw eight members of your family die in front of your eyes, do you think you would have responded in kind? And just leave it at that.
So there's no doubt in your mind and in the conclusion of Human Rights Watch that this actually occurred, because there's also been some denial, unbelievably enough, I'm just saying from my perspective this is unbelievable, that this ever happened.
Well, you know, there are a number of people in this country that don't believe that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, and that's their prerogative to believe that, regardless of the evidence. And here we have 8 dead civilians. And we've got some incredibly corroborative, just, it's amazing how much evidence there is. And so to actually question that it happened is beyond shocking to me. It's actually quite disgusting.
Let's talk about the current situation in Gaza right now. Can you give us an overview of what's happening and then what the position of Human Rights Watch is on it, on the situation?
Yeah, I can speak quickly to it, and then I actually have to go to another interview. You know, right now our main concern is of the potential for a humanitarian crisis. There is a huge lack of power there. They're completely dependent now on power from Israel. The hospitals, the water treatment are a big problem. For a while there, it was looking like food and fuel were coming to a head, where they were going to run out. But Israel today opened up the Karni crossing to allow some in at the request of the Red Cross. And so hopefully that will get people, you know, by for the next few days. They said Karni will be open for the next 4 days. Hopefully that'll be the case and things can be assuaged. But still, we have a large number of combat troops in Israel, in Gaza right now, and things are going to be coming to a head. Hopefully we won't be seeing massive civilian casualties.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Mark.
Hey, thanks a lot. It's been my pleasure being on your show. Take care now.
You too.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Mark Galasko, senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch. He recently returned from Gaza, where he investigated the June 9th shelling deaths of a Palestinian family on a beach there. And if you want more information, you can go to Human Rights Watch website, which is hrw.org. That's hrw.org, stands for Human Rights Watch, where you can read their reports